Ladies and gentlemen, it is May 12, 2022. I am Matt Belinsky, and this is your weekly dose of sanity, the prevailing narrative. So the battle of the sexes is raging on right now. Gender politics are coming to a head in America around two issues. One, the supposed or anticipated overturning of Roe v. Wade and the abortion issue, and the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial, which is a bit of a proxy battle over the legacy of Me Too and where Me Too has left our society in gender relations. It's interesting that these two issues are coming to a head almost simultaneously. So the abortion issue, incredibly dense, incredibly complicated, despite contrary to what you might hear from some people. I'm going to give that issue its due on the next episode. That's not one I'm going to dive into too deeply today, but we'll just get into one aspect of that because I think it has a parallel to the Amber Heard Johnny Depp situation. On both the abortion issue and Me Too, and as it's being almost adjudicated between within the context of Amber Heard and Johnny Depp, this whole idea that there's one, you know, stayed fixed, calcified female opinion and one calcified fixed male opinion, and the sexes are essentially battling over that. That is, one, ridiculous in concept, but two, just factually wrong, right? And this is where I keep on going back to on the abortion debate, and one argument I push against, and because I push back against it, people think that I'm anti-abortion, but I'm not. I'm pro-choice with some limitations. Once again, not going to get into the specifics, but it's like there's an underlying argument about abortion that men should not have an opinion or be passing any laws having to do with women's bodies, right? That this is that any opposition to abortion is just being propagated by men. And that's simply false. If you look at any polling on this topic, there's millions upon millions of women who are against abortion. Once again, I don't necessarily agree with them, but don't take it up with me, take it up with them. If you look at opinions on abortion, you can look at any number of polls. The idea that there's some big gap where all these men are against abortion and all these women are pro-abortion and there's this massive gender gap there, it's simply not true, right? There's a very small gap within 4 to 6 points typically on any variety of abortion issues and abortion sub-issues. So if you want to, in a democratic nation and, you know, in trying to adjudicate the free exchange of ideas, if we need to work through this issue, we need to acknowledge that there are a ton of women who are against abortion, right? And that this kind of oversimplification of one male opinion, one female opinion is not an accurate representation of reality. So I think that that's something that needs to be wrestled with as we go through the exercise of trying to resolve the abortion issue. So, okay. Putting a pin in that. Can you get to that next week? Similarly, Amber Heard, Johnny Depp. Like I said, a bit of the proxy battle for the legacy of Me Too. Now, looking back on Me Too, where did it go right? Where did it go wrong? Where did it leave us? What are our views and approaches towards gender relations, towards assessing the validity of claims one direction or the other? And during the heyday of Me Too, let's call it 2016 through 2000, I mean, could it just be the Trump era? Was that the golden age of Me Too, 2016 to 2020? Maybe an interesting question to ponder. But the idea was that this was just women fighting back finally against male oppression, and that the kind of tropes and considerations and mechanics of Me Too were supported by all women. For instance, the quote and the slogan, believe all women. And if you look under the hood, it, once again, simply not true. There were tons and tons of women who were not on board, were not aligned with that way of thinking, and did not believe that any member of one gender or the other should be per se believed just based on accusation. And so you're seeing that play out now quite a bit on the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial, because everyone is now, seems like now everyone has become comfortable with the notion that, so we'll see how this trial plays out, but it seems like now it is an acceptable public opinion that there could be a female who presents herself as a victim of domestic abuse or sexual violence and is actually lying, is actually making false allegations, whether fully false or partially false, right? And so, okay, as I record this, we've heard mostly from Johnny Depp in this trial so far, a couple days into Amber Heard's testimony, and she's giving, we have to assess her validity as well. And maybe some of her claims, while not all true, maybe some of her claims do have validity. And it does seem that Johnny Depp wasn't necessarily some angel. But if you look at the totality of the testimony, it's pretty clear that whatever Amber Heard presented herself as, such some damsel in distress, poor, you know, victim of one way abuse and sexual violence, It's the likelihood that that is true is incredibly minuscule. And now it is acceptable to voice that. It would not have been acceptable, or you would have been putting yourself at risk 3-4 years ago if there was a female allegation of abuse against a male. To come to the male's defense meant you were putting yourself at risk. There was consequence to that. So there doesn't seem to be anywhere. We can now assess this more soberly based on the facts, or at least attempt to assess those based on the facts. So this tweet I found the other day I thought was very telling. It goes, I would like to thank Amber Heard for nailing the coffin shut on the ridiculous assertion that 50% of the population should automatically be trusted at face value for no other reason than their gender. Okay, so first off, yes, the idea that you should be trusted just specifically based on your gender, absolutely ridiculous. Okay, so now if we're looking at how the Johnny Depp Amber Heard situation is waking us back up to that reality, I mean, you look at the gender breakdown of who's supporting who, and there's just a ton of women who seem to be skeptical of Amber Heard. So were these women kind of part of the Me Too, believe all women hysteria in 2017 and 18, and now this situation has woken them up? Or did they have these views, but were scared of the social consequences and the pushback if they dared voice any opinion to the contrary during that period, right? We were all living in a period where we had to buy into the hysteria that you were putting yourself at risk by the very reasonable assertion, basic due process, that someone, that the accused has a presumption of innocence and that any claims need to be put to scrutiny. Because the idea that people don't have ill motives, don't have malicious motives, is ridiculous. That why would someone lie? Well, because they want to get this person. Because they either want money, they want to harm someone, they have selfish ulterior motives. That is part of humanity, and that's why we have to put assertions and claims, particularly claims of serious abuse, to scrutiny, right? And we just toss that concept out the window. So I posted this tweet on my Instagram, and if you look at the likes, it's overwhelmingly female. So it seems to expose the myth that there truly is a battle of the sexes, that within each gender, within male and female, there is any variety of opinions and points of view and perspectives. And unless we discuss, unless we try to work through gender issues, understanding that, we're going to keep on missing the mark. And there seems to be an imbalance. I don't want to get too woo-woo right now, but an imbalance in the equilibrium, the spiritual equilibrium between male and female in America right now, that manifests itself in a number of different ways. But I think if we're going to try to find, you know, that equilibrium once again, or come to healthier gender relations, we've got to understand that there's not just one point of view based on your chromosomes, that based on whether you're a man or woman, that there's such a variety of opinion within each group, and we have to take that into account when trying to work through these issues. Seems pretty sensible, no? Okay, so a gentleman that I have on to discuss these issues this week, his name is Greg Ellis. Now, what is Greg Ellis's relevance to these issues? One, he's good friends with Johnny Depp and has been close and alongside Johnny throughout this entire saga. Two, he had his life destroyed by false allegations from his ex-wife. You've got to hear the story. It is beyond belief, right? And we need to be abreast. We need to be cognizant of the consequences and the harm that come from false allegations, and the fact that they, while they are not the majority, by some assessments, they are the majority, but regardless of how often false accusations occur, what the consequences of false allegations are. So Greg has written a book on this topic called The Respondent. It goes through both his personal saga and, you know, how this is adjudicated, how this is seen by the American legal system, particularly the family law system, which I think a lot of people are unaware of. The family law system operates by completely different standards and precepts than the criminal law system, and a lot that really, there's a lot of injustice here, right? So the family law court system and family law in general seems to be incredibly outdated. It's a relic from the early 20th century, when men were just the overwhelming amount of the workforce and the income, and most families were one income families, and it's shaped in that manner. I think it needs updating. So Greg is going to describe what he has seen from the belly of the beast, both through his personal odyssey and journey through the American family law system, and from what he's seen on the Johnny Depp Amber Heard situation as a bit of an insider there. I think it's a super interesting discussion. So our conversation looks at this issue both with a microscope as to Greg's personal circumstances and the Heard Depp scenario, and zooming out and looking at it with a telescope as kind of a broader survey and understanding of gender relations, both, you know, macro or both kind of intangibly, and as is looked upon by the American family law system. So that conversation is coming up in just a minute. Please stick around. Ladies and gentlemen, I am Matt Belinsky, and this is The Prevailing Narrative. Today I'm here with Greg Ellis. Greg is a renowned actor, appearing in such films as Star Trek and Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. He's also the author of numerous books, including The Respondent, Exposing the Cartel of Family Law. The respondent is a firsthand account of Greg's odyssey through the family law system after false accusations from his ex-wife left him committed to a mental institution against his will, destitute, and estranged from his children. The respondent includes an intro from a man named Johnny Depp, who's currently the centerpiece of a national conversation about domestic abuse, false allegations, and trial in the court of public opinion. Greg, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Matt. It's great to be on.
So in your writings and some of your social media content, before we get into the specifics of this odyssey I just referenced, you refer to the people as the respondent sometimes conceptually. And I always found that interesting. So I was wondering, before we get into your specific story, what is the respondent as a concept as you use it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's multiple things that it means to me, the word itself, how we define it, how we can be more responsible and self-reliant and less reactive, particularly in our cancel culture times where everyone's drunk on Woca-Cola, as I call it. How do we respond to allegations, particularly false allegations? So in a sense, you know, I talk about we're all response able. We all have the ability to be more responsive and less reactive, to influence our impulse control in these trying social media times, where everything is about the clickbait and the reactionary, impulse. So it's really that, you know, and part of it as well, because of my odyssey and my journey, my personal journey. Was how I could reflect back on self, because I think that's ultimately where it begins and ends, is looking into the mirror of self.
It's very interesting. In that it goes back, it takes me back to a book called A Man in Full by Tom Wolfe, in that one of the storylines in that book was about a man who was tested. This was a blue collar worker who was not, you know, kind of as thoughtful and sophisticated as a lot of Tom Wolfe's characters, and turned towards, you know, kind of his journey into stoicism and dealing with that, and, you know, and kind of looking into the abyss and seeing his, you know, what looks back at him. And I find that kind of an interesting bookend to how you see the respondent. So the age of cancel culture and hysteria. Why do you think social media is obviously the low-hanging fruit and the easy explanation for why this era seems to have a bias towards hysteria. Do you have any further thoughts on why this era seems to not have the guardrails against judicious kind of patient thought and consideration of the facts that prior eras may have had?
Good question. I think part of it is the age of modernity. And technology. I think going back further than that, the evolution of language and words and the etymology of words. I do think recently we've had this great awakening, I think, of the 2010s that ushered in an age of unreason, of uncivil discourse, and an era, if you will, of cancel culture. And I do think, you know, in terms of capitalism as well, you know, I talked about woke capitalism. I think we're living in an era of woke capitalism in which companies pretend to care about social justice to sell products to people who pretend to hate capitalism. And there is, it's almost like the upside down, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It is a strange inversion. And also it feels odd that it's so transparent that these profit driven corporations seem to be pandering, but everyone, there's this kind of preference falsification where everyone has to seemingly play along and pretend that what they're doing actually has substance to it. But, you know, it's purely just a good idea, that a thought bubble that sprouted up in the marketing department.
Yeah, I think the woke wave has kind of crested, and people are beginning to see behind the curtain more. And, you know, with regards to all of the touchpoint issues that have been out there recently, like BLM and critical race theory and you know, trans activism, many of these hot button issues, people are really feeling like they can at last maybe speak up, and not without the fear of being cancelled, but the courage to not not care as much about being canceled. It's like,
in assessing bark versus bite, there still might be some bite anticipated, but the bite's not going to go as deep, perhaps. And one of the other issues where that's some of the hysteria seems to be dissolving is around Believe All Women and the kind of disregarding of due process in, you know, any sort of accusation of sexual or romantic misconduct. And so obviously Johnny Depp trial is front and center right now, and we'll get to that in a minute. But
what you said about Believe All Women, you know, I've said this before, we shouldn't believe any group of people. We should listen to individuals that happen to be a part of the group. I think that's, you know, important.
Well, that just betrays every principle of due process that traces all the way back to the Magna Carta and that we've built our society on, and, you know, the understanding that, believe it or not, not everybody has great motives. Dismissing the notion that people have malicious motives or are fabricating lies to harm others out of selfish concerns, I mean, this is just a basic precept of humanity. And as I think we've seen recently, to believe that everybody, that the question of why would someone lie, if you can't come up with an answer for why would someone lie, you're not thinking hard enough.
Yeah, we all have the propensity for malevolence within us. And I think, you know, as well, you know, you mentioned jurisprudence and the Magna Carta. That's a good throwback to a long ago. Is what I've seen recently with speech being violence and the speech police and hate crimes. And, you know, where is the line, the incitement to violence? I mean, apologies for non-crimes will or hate crimes that are spoken words will merely expand the scope of what constitutes a crime, and your guilt is presumed axiomatically. Yeah. You know, and your apologies won't change that. Your apology will generate no forgiveness whatsoever. It's merely an admission that your persecutors were right all along, and they'll come after you even more. That's the Spanish Inquisition, the Salem witch trials. It's this notion,
superstition and hysteria,
right? And yeah, and jurisprudence, as you mentioned, the burden of proof being on the accused rather than the accuser. There's a reason why we introduced jurisprudence into Western civilization, and to do away with the guilty till proven more guilty.
Yeah. And this is something that comes up in conversations that I have all the time, because anytime I try to inject the notion of due process or freedom of speech or burden of proof, all these things into conversations outside of a courtroom, you know, because I'm a lawyer, I always get the retort, well, this isn't a courtroom. This isn't the legal system. Well, guys, there's a reason the legal system operates the way it does. It's because over centuries, we have refined something to try to, it is the best set of policies to aim towards a truthful outcome and justice. And while imperfect, and there's a reason why we have due process and presumption of innocence. They're good things. The idea that they should only exist where they're legally mandated to exist is, of course, nonsense.
Yeah, and the notion that it's not going to affect you if it's outside a courtroom is spurious. I mean, you look at recently, I think it was last year, Scotland brought in a hate crime law that made it
dystopian,
permissible for law enforcement and the police to enter your home and arrest and detain you for words you've spoken around your kitchen table.
Yeah.
So, I mean, people need to wise up on this, right?
There were a number of guardrails in place, and understanding that, you know, while the line drawn from freedom of speech might drift in one direction here or there a little bit, in some parts of the Western world, it's starting to get into kind of a sci-fi dystopian realm. You know, Minority Report is the film that everybody references, but being punished for things that you may have not, you know, things that you've communicated in private or simply expressing oneself, you know, that do not slant towards threats of violence or other types of speech that have been deemed legal over the centuries. And it's starting to creep in there a little bit. And as we've seen with lots of these movements, many people don't wake up to it until it's too late. So hopefully,
going to say that there's this groupthink. I mean, we talk about the identity politics and groupthink, and, you know, the objection to identity politics is not to people having identities that they find meaningful or they want to identify as. It's an objection to the politicizing of the identity and telling people that because someone has a certain identity, they should think, feel, and act a certain way as though they're not individuals. And that's the mob mentality and the cancel culture of social murder. You know, and identity politics, it damages our sense of shared humanity and
exactly.
Reduces empathy between groups, because there's always going to be groups that we identify with, right?
Well, because also the one thing that the one place that we can all come together and find common ground is that we're humans, right? Is that we have a shared human experience. And if you encourage everybody to view everything through the prism of their identity, you're robbing the people of that shared space as humans.
Yeah. And I think I agree. We're in this position because I think identity politics is, in its current form at least, is a collective ideology. It's very collectivist. It doesn't value...
On tribal.
Well, yeah, tribal, collectivist, the group, the mob. It doesn't value an individual for the content of his or her character, but instead makes these prejudicial assessments on the basis of race or gender and sexuality. So in the name of anti-racism, identity politics has kind of rehabilitated racial thinking. And I come from, obviously a small town in England. So, I'm not as connected to the historical, the oppression that's happened within America. But there does seem to be a lack of conversation about class. And it's more focused on the immutable characteristic. And there are many people suffering. I believe everyone's suffering with something.
Sure. And there's been some peripheral assessments of this era in that some people, theorize the following, that because the upper class wanted to fend off any class hostilities, class-based hostilities, when income inequality shot through the roof in America, during the first part of the 21st century, and that the elites, while not, purely centralized and conspiratorially, that the elites and corporations and the professional managerial class decided to gear the conversation towards race, ethnicity, and identity as opposed to material concerns because, damn, if those who have more challenging material lives start getting pissed off at us just based off class, if that's where the battle line is drawn, we're going to lose and we're in trouble. We can divide and conquer everybody by just chopping them up into identity categories.
Yeah, I hear you. And going back to actually, historically find out where these movements, I remember thinking when I first started out in The Respondent, like, where did this toxic masculinity catchphrase come from? And I spoke with Erin Pizzi, who, wonderful lady, she's in her 80s now, nearly 52 years ago, she started the world's first domestic abuse shelter for women. And she found that of 6 of the 10 women who came into her shelter were as violent or more violent than the men that they left. And she spoke out about this back in, it must have been the 70s. And she was vilified. A cat was poisoned and killed. A bomb squad was sent to her home. And she got hounded out of England. And in conversation with her, she told me about this meeting in 1969 of the feminist movement, and that they decided at that meeting, I believe it was in New York, to pivot their message to focus on two words. And those two words were toxic and masculinity. And then decades later, of course, what do we see? We see this demonization of masculinity, all men bad, toxic masculinity, smash the patriarch. And I don't think demonizing masculinity it's not the solution, it's the problem. At a time when modern fathers and males and men and younger generation of boys are bombarded with these messages about the deeply corrosive effects of toxic masculinity, we're also confronted with institutions psychologically conditioned now to think that the male, the man, masculinity is toxic. And it's nonsense. I was talking with a journalist the other day about this trial and the Johnny Depp trial. And mid-conversation, he said, we men have to make amends for our 500 to 600 years of patriarchal oppression. And I'm thinking, hang on a minute. I mean, there are some things that men got right, aren't there? Please.
Let's call it the building of society. And also, and this is what I always go back to, is that the complete ignorance as to how the physical environment worked. Okay. You want to know why men were the ones who worked back in 1783? Because women did have to be in the home at that time, because if not, it was hard to keep a child alive. right? The go look at infant death rates. Okay, it was you did not just go down to the grocery store and go get baby formula. You didn't just turn on the faucet and have running water all the time. You didn't have machines doing your laundry. Like, the physical environment only really over the past 75 to 100 years has even accommodated not having the caregiver, the mother, in the home to raise the child and make sure that the child doesn't die each day. The physical environment and before certain technological developments did not lend itself to two income households and not having at least one caregiver at the home during the day all the time. And given the challenges of the physical environment, the male was more physically equipped to be out there, whether it was farming and hunting and during a more agrarian periods, or as things became industrialized, taking on more industrial professions and whatnot. It's like everyone thinks that they didn't have air conditioning in 1663. Okay, people encountered a physical environment that we could not even fathom, and gender roles flowed mostly from that. Now it's fantastic. The technology has evolved, that now technology allows us to essentially outsource or mechanize any number of life's functions that free up women and free up the parental relationship, that everybody can go and pursue their vocations and not necessarily have to be consumed with these day-to-day items. It's great that we live in that era. But if we're going to essentially create this alternate history where our ancestors encountered the physical environment that we do, and gender roles were just a vestige of oppression, that's simply not true. It is, in fact, it's ridiculous.
And we'll have more of the prevailing narrative after the break.
Yeah, I mean, I think of hunter-gatherer, I think of, well, I mean, you just said it all. I don't really need to add to that. I think we, in Jungian psychology, we talk of animus and anima, and the feminine traits within the masculine and the masculine traits within the feminine. And perhaps maybe some of what we're seeing is this, the rise of the masculine traits within the feminine. And that need for dominance and power, or the mm-hmm. necessity or desire for that.
Sure.
And ultimately, I think, I've talked about this a lot on my show, with the with equality feminism. There are different types of feminism. There's, the equality,
absolutely,
empowerment, true empathic feminists who want equal rights. And I'm with them, and I'm all on board with that message. But this more radical strain of third and fourth wave neo-feminism, one might call it, or postmodern progressive feminism that seeks to vilify men and males. I read some of the literature that's written by these female authors sometimes that are calling for the exact same behavior that they're vilifying in the man.
Absolutely.
And it's just preposterous. And that's, they're selling loads of copies of books and getting published, and so our society's in an interesting place.
We have a strange the equilibrium between the sexes is definitely off right now, and it's also a bit of a generational thing, because I look at my mother. She's in her early 70s. She's a baby boomer feminist, a second wave feminist, and those notions were purely that females should not be discriminated against for professional concerns or the desire to get out into the workforce and be treated just like everybody else. Seems pretty reasonable, does it not? A lot of, they're not as vocal because they're not young and they're not on social media. But if you speak with my mother and some of her friends and that generation of feminists, they're not necessarily on board with a lot of stuff that they're seeing right now, particularly in terms of how the approach to gender politics is being taken and how sexual politics funnels in there, because along with this new fourth wave of feminism comes sex empowerment, that not only are we searching for professional respect and equality in the workplace, but also a celebration of female sexuality and desire. And that was not part of the second wave of feminism back in the 60s and 70s. And they were trying to a certain extent, desexualize their image, that they were looking to be, they're saying, hey, stop judging us just based on our physical beauty or physical purposes or sexuality or whatnot. And now that's, if you want to see something that's flipped on its head, it's the vanguard of the feminist movement and how they view women presenting themselves as sexual beings. And if you talk to a feminist in 1972 and a feminist in 2022, they will have completely different views on that.
Yeah, that's, you're spot on. And I think the truth is that, you know, we have this seemingly callous indifference right now to male death and suffering, and a disconcerting comfort level with male disposability. She's been, I think it's been society's default position for probably thousands of years, you know, in terms of...
Because that's another point. And then when people try to explain, okay, why are males so dominant at the upper echelons of society leadership, you know, both political and business leadership? It's, well, men generally slant higher and men generally slant lower. Okay. If you go look at the dregs of society, criminals, homeless, suicide, depression, you're going to see that the numbers are far higher for males. So males are likely, or more likely, to slant high and slant low. And that all traces back to kind of evolutionary causes that males needed to be more bigger risk takers and have more of an appetite for risk for the largest share of humanity in our experience, where they might get killed, where they left the house each day. You know, it might have been a life or death scenario, or whether or not they succeeded at what their goals were that day would be whether their family could gain sustenance and perpetuate itself, right? So these things, if people don't have a historical and evolutionary perspective on it and just pretend that humanity woke up one day in, you know, 1980 and we had, you know, VHS, the most ancient technology is VHS and, like, maybe, you know, a low-grade air conditioning system, I mean, you're not going to understand why we are where we're at, right? You have to have a more historical and longer range view to these things.
Yeah, there's a difference. You know, little boys play with different toys than girls. They fight with clenched fists, not sharp fingernails. And the risk reward of the male, you know, to go out. I mean, I think of the matriarch and the patriarch, mother and father. You know, a mother, and this is obviously, I'm generalizing here for anyone who's listening and thinking, oh gosh, that's such a misogynist, stereotypical man thing to say. You know, mother will bring in the child. Are you okay? Will tend to and nurture. You know, that's that mother nurture. And I think part of the patriarchal role is to risk take, is to, you know, take some risks and teach, particularly our boys. You know, life's going to be tough. It's going to be dangerous, and there's going to be some mishaps and mistakes along the way. And but you have to take risks for reward. Otherwise, you live a safe, you know.
And that is not, and try. And here's the strangest thing about all of this to me: when you have to caveat a comment about acknowledging, you know, the feminine as nurturing, that you have to caveat it that some people will see that as a bad thing. Anyone ever query whether these are actually good things? It's a good thing that females are nurturing and then men are more are bigger risk takers, and that this is simply a kind of this is simply an acknowledgement of, you know, of the balance, a polarity between the sexes, and that, you know, and having two sexes with supplemental characteristics is good, and neither is being vilified one way or the other. It's like nobody, that never seems to occur to anybody. But
I think what we then start to kind of encourage is this kind of more helicopter parented kids, and particularly boys, young boys, generations, boys that need feeling spaces. And of course, you know, I'm all about, you know, I'm an actor and I'm an artist. So, you know, I reside in, yeah, empathic and compassionate. You know, but, you know, traditionally men have fought wars and, you know, for the most part, run into burning buildings, put up high rise. But there is some physical attributes to the male compared to the female overall in general that are going to, and look, I remember my ex-wife, when we first married, she didn't want to, I wanted her to stay home, not because I had this kind of, you know, patriarchal, outdated, traditional gender roles ideology, just because I thought it'd be nice for her to, you know, be with the kids. And make a beautiful home. She didn't want to do that. I was fine with that. I encouraged and, you know, got behind what she wanted, which was to go out and work. So, you know, we should be open to it. But I also think this demonization of, from certain parts of society, of women who want to stay home And we need to champion and champion that as well, and say that's, if you want to do that, that's a that's one of the greatest roles of a lifetime.
It's, we need to value mother, yeah.
Valuing the matriarch, you know, and you know, going back to the dad, you know, the primary role of a father, you know, and the whole hunter gatherer and kind of behavior over history and time. I think a primary role of a father, or one of the primary roles, is to maintain an aura or a presence, if you will, that says, look, you know, look and listen and watch through experience, son. Life has problems. We're going to solve them together. And you know, part of that is the learning of boundary setting and self-discipline. You know, men traditionally, fathers are more
disciplinarian,
exactly. And how to instill a sense, you know, we learn things through the boundary setting and the roughhousing as boys. Mm-hmm. You know, we get to instill a sense of empathy for ourselves, for our partners, for our peers and friends, and eventually our wives or life partners.
They're great character lessons to be learned through the, you know, more traditional exploration of gender roles and the demonization, and you know, to the idea that lending ourselves to those more traditional exercises and roles simply stifles or negates the possibility of women succeeding in the professional world is ridiculous. There's absolutely room for both, but more specifically now, because you have such a captivating story, you know, you are the respondent. You were originally the respondent. You had your life turned upside down, as Johnny Depp put it, you know, in a 0.6 seconds, you can go from Cinderella to Quasimodo. And that's, to a certain extent, what happened to you. Would love to hear your saga, both in your having your life turned upside down and then your journey through the family law system.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's I write about it. The story is in the book, The Respondent. I also have a free downloadable ebook as a follow up called The Code, mm-hmm. which is to help people that find themselves in situations like I did. But, you know, in summary, one moment I was a successful actor and director producer living in an expansive Hollywood home with my wife of nearly 20 years and two young sons that I adored, that were the meaning of my life. And everything changed with a knock on the door by police. And that was the first engagement, if you will, in a battle with America's unscrupulous and unstoppable family law cartel that's raged on for years and left me with scars, my family in ashes, and my beautiful boys without a father. And the book and the project, The Respondent, really just emerged from that devastating, catastrophic experience. It's part memoir, part meditation, and part manifesto. And I also offer some solutions, you know, and recommendations for how we can improve this system. But fundamentally, I was staggered, Matt, to learn that, you know, and you're an attorney, that family law is the one branch of our legal system that doesn't provide due process and the presumption of innocence and jurisprudence. And to find out that criminals get more rights than parents and families and by de facto children in a branch of our legal system in 2022 is simply staggering and totally unacceptable.
Yeah, that is something that admittedly I hadn't necessarily thought. I thought I don't do family law, but I've got some familiarity with it. And you think, wait a second, oh my God, an accusation of domestic violence. Okay, if you are pressing criminal charges and are trying to route that through the court system and incarcerate someone for assault, let's just say, they get due process and a presumption of innocence and whatnot. But for purposes of determining, you know, apportioning family assets or child custody, and within that prism, all of a sudden all that is thrown out the window. You found yourself in kind of a Kafka-esque nightmare, institutionalized against your will, I believe so.
Five times.
How was
one
it
time in solitary confinement in a police cell? How? Well, that's, you know, I write about in the book that I call it the six silver bullets of high conflict divorce and the magic ballistics of family law war. And they literally, this is literally the super weapon playbook that these attorneys like Samantha Spector, who represented Amber Heard originally, mm-hmm. Attorneys like Judy Bogan, who represented my ex-wife, Laura Wasser, the kind of high powered $1,000 and up Beverly Hills cartel, as I call them, mm-hmm. They use this super weapon, and it's devastating. I mean, the notion that you can make a false allegation against anyone, you can pick up the phone. There is an anonymous hotline. You can pick up the phone and within 15 minutes ruin someone's life is staggering to me. So I call it the silver bullet because, you know, silver bullets defined as simple, seemingly, and that's the key word, seemingly magical solutions to difficult problems. And in family law, that's marriage disillusionment. And it really is, these silver bullets are the ammunition for the smoking gun, if you will, in the wild west of family law. And where's more of a wild west than California? And they have become the go-to playbook for divorce lawyers and petitioners. And when you look at the statistics, 80% of petitioners, which is the person who actually files for divorce, are women. And if you look at educated women, it goes up to 90%. So it's really just this war-fighting philosophy aimed at crippling the opponent before the conflict really begins. It's unethical, underhanded, manipulation, to really just force the enemy, the respondent, the future ex, to fight for hearth and home. And the stakes are enormous. You know, they involve nothing less than your future, your freedom, your reputation, your children, your home, and maybe even your life. I mean, I've read so many of the suicide notes from fathers and forsaken fathers, forgotten men, who just couldn't endure what I call the living grief of separation from their children and this interminable, inescapable system. And I coined the phrase suicide by living grief because there is a finality to the grief of someone passing or a loss. But with this false accusation in domestic violence, and again, I'm going to preface and say that I'm going to say over 70% of accusations of domestic violence, over 70% don't move from the evidentiary phase, from a TRO or an EPO, a temporary restraining or emergency protection order. Once they move to a hearing phase, they don't move past that, which shows that they're temporary for a reason and they're easy to get. And if there was any evidence there, and we don't rely on hearsay evidence anywhere else, it would stick, and they don't stick. So these people who make these false allegations are an affront to the real victims of domestic violence.
Sure.
I talk about the silver bullets. The first one I call the incarcerating incident. And that's the making of the false or hearsay allegation. The reputation savages the respondent and is meant to confuse and conflate the entire family law matter, and it does. Then you move fast to silver bullet two, which is the order of restraint. They give them out like hot dinners these days. They're so easy to get. This is when the petitioner doubles down on the false allegations and gains a restraining order, usually a TRO or an EPO, with the motive to force the respondent to become homeless, childless, and fight criminal charges sometimes.
So interesting there. To become homeless, is that essentially cutting them off from, let's call it, joint bank accounts and other community property assets? Is that how that works?
Well, first and foremost, it's to have a distance between the petitioner, the person who's got the TRO or the EPO. Let's say, for example, in this case, we'll reference Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. So Amber Heard, with her attorney, Samantha Spector, went to Los Angeles Stanley Moss Courthouse, I believe it was. I think it was May 2016, on an ex parte basis. For those who don't know, that's an emergency hearing. Mm-hmm. And if an attorney goes in ex parte, they have to give notice to the other side.
Correct.
Samantha Spector, as I understand it, and it's been testified in court recently, she did not give notice. They did not give notice to Laura Wasser, Johnny Depp's attorney at the time. So there's a breaching of the rules. That's unethical to begin with. They also knew that Johnny was in New York across the country and about to be in Europe on tour, so he couldn't appear at an ex parte hearing. And this judge, who I believe was extremely friendly with Samantha Spector, granted this TRO, which was the basis of everything. So that's the restraining order. It basically meant that he had to keep a distance. He couldn't go near her, couldn't communicate. And of course, if there were children involved, if they had children together, that would probably include the children and the pets and the house and the home. But getting to your points, silver bullet three, as I call it, is the security lock. And that's when the petitioner secures or steals the family possessions or claims them, changes the locks, the passcodes on everything, protects, quote unquote, the children from the respondent. And it's social isolation. And it's a very effective weapon because, in effect, it removes you from the ability to have any access to your material possessions. Your computer, like I didn't even have access to my files, my folders, my work stuff, my computer, my entire technological life was shut down.
I imagine no access to your home, which you had been the primary financier of.
Yeah, I mean, I left home at 17 with very little money in my pocket and worked my entire life. We hear a lot about white privilege, but mine was earned privilege and unearned privilege. And I worked hard to get where I got to. And I built figuratively and literally to a certain degree a beautiful home, and in an instant became homeless and had no access to that. In fact, there was a judge who ordered that I have access to my home and be able to go and get my possessions. And I was met by three men in black with video cameras videotaping me, who summarily proceeded to tell me that I couldn't access my home. And they just gave me a couple of boxes, cardboard boxes. And I was staggered at that point. It was like Kafka-esque. How a judge has ordered that I can go into my own home. And then I get there and these three goons in black, basically, telling me, you're not going into your home. You can't have your possessions. Get off your own property.
That is wild. And that this is a saga that obviously this was not resolved quickly. As you mentioned, you were incarcerated five times. I imagine not for any particular incident caught in an incident of violence just based off these accusations alone.
Yeah, I say this too often. I've never been arrested. I've never been tried for a crime. I was detained each time. And this is, I think, the kind of the heart of it, Matt, that I try and explain about how horrific this part of the legal system is. And you're always going to have, you're an attorney. There are really good, upstanding, ethical attorneys. And there are some who push the bar and the limits. And in family law, there's no oversight. There's no executive oversight.
And also the family law is very small. And that's something that I think the family law community is very insular. Okay. Everybody, the judges know the lawyers know the judges. In other realms of the legal system, civil litigation, for instance, you could go your entire career, a decade, not encountering the same lawyer, the same judge. It's a wider community. Things in the family law world are, particularly in Los Angeles, are very incestuous, very insular.
Yeah, I mean, they throw galas and parties and for each other, the judges and the attorneys, and the judges are mainly, from law firms. I mean, that's how it goes, I think, in law. You want judges who have an understanding and an experience of the law, and there are some really wonderful attorneys that I know. And it's a very noble profession. But I was talking with Alan Dershowitz about family law, and he was saying, that's where the dreadful school go, because it's easy money where you don't have to work that hard. You can literally plant your own money trees. They call it churning, racking up the billable hours at the expense of families and children and parents.
If you were willing to deal with the toxicity of the situations, that's what always was tipped off to me about family. I was like, wait, I don't want to have to get my hands dirty like this. This cannot be good for your soul and your inner constitution to have to be dealing with these poisonous, hostile situations all day long.
Yeah, and to perpetrate them. I mean, I do believe that with Amber Heard, she was encouraged by Samantha Spector to shoot the silver bullet of the false accusation of domestic violence. And I think what's important here is, this trial isn't about that, even though that's part of it. This trial is really about whether she defamed Johnny Depp in that article. And she wrote that article. I believe the first iteration of that article did mention him. And, as any good publication has, they have their lawyers who scour over everything, and his name was removed. But her name is on the article. Whether she had it ghostwritten by the ACLU, which it sounds like the first.
She almost certainly did, yes.
She put her name to it, and it was out there. And I think it's really egregious when we have Because it's now proven, you know, it's in testimony that she said she would start physical fights because she'd rather keep him there and fight with him physically than have him leave. Mm-hmm. And I think this cuts to the question of our approach towards domestic violence and intimate partner violence and physical abuse. You know, we chastise and vilify and castigate, rightfully so, men who are physically violent towards women. It's unforgivable, and they need to be brought to account and held to account. But our attitude towards men who are being physically abused has been really, I mean, men get ridiculed and laughed at, and you're a source of derision, and you need to be stronger than that. Why are you putting up with that? You've been hit by a woman, like all of that. And I think if we're looking in this era of equality, and we want equality, then we need to say, look, abuse has no gender, and the truth has no gender. And the fact of the matter is, she's now admitted to physically abusing Johnny Depp,
and she became
a spokesperson for domestic violence.
And see, that's okay. And going back to the Washington Post article, because what the legal trick, the manipulation that they were trying to engage in, was by not mentioning him directly and by not mentioning a specific incident of violence, they thought that they could skirt behind, well, because defamation is about a misrepresentation about an identifiable person, is that, oh, you can't, we didn't identify that it was Johnny Depp, and they thought that that could save them. And it looks like that alone, at least, we'll have to see the court's ruling, but at least in terms of trying to get the case dismissed, the fact that they did not reference his name directly or any specific incident is not going to save them, because anyone who's reading that knows who they're talking about and can identify that, you know, the people who read this will understand that it's about Johnny Depp. So that was where they got a little too cute and a little too arrogant about being able to kind of use these little tricks and tactics to avoid a defamation claim. And then as to your point about, you know, not believing that there are female abusers, I mean, she hung it all on display for everybody to see. She said she codified all this imperfectly of the, once again, the arrogance and the condescension that simply nobody will believe a man. And she outright said, as she's heard recorded speaking, "Tell the world, Johnny, tell the world I, Johnny Depp, a white man, am a victim of domestic violence, and see who believes you. See how many people take your side." And she's taunting him. And she's taunting him with the kind of the notion that nobody will believe him, because hey, what type of man, Johnny Depp, supposed to be known as a swaggering, you know, tough leather jacket wearing 21 Jump Street movie star would be attacked by somebody? But at this point, regardless of, you know, we're on to the second half of the trial. We'll see if she's able to proffer any evidence to the effect that he was physically abusive. What is unquestioned at this point is that she was physically abusive.
And we'll have more of the prevailing narrative after the break.
Amber Heard is almost doing us a favor on a larger extent of exposing the lies and the fallacies of believing this could only go one way.
Yeah, and like going back to what we talked about at the start, you know, believe all women. We should never believe all of one particular group.
Every situation needs to be subjected to scrutiny based on the facts and circumstances.
Yeah, and again, you know, I get why both sides, and it is both sides, are going into the character breakdowns of the other. But this is defamation trial, and you know, defamation is defined as the action of damaging the good reputation of someone, slander or libel. And it's a high bar, as you well know. And I doubt whether he's going to win just because of the bar being so high.
Sure.
But we'll see what this jury of eight men and four women decide. But I think, you know, I've said this before, this trial is more important than two celebrities, Matt. It's about whether society cares enough to hold a woman accountable for falsely claiming domestic abuse and reputation savaging a man's career. A great career, one of the best careers, dare I say. I mean, if you were to put someone on trial for this, who was so, you know, someone more beloved, I can't, other than Tom Hanks and maybe a couple of others, than Johnny Depp. Those who've worked with him for decades in the industry know the measure of the man and his character.
You were friends with Johnny Depp. You've been friends with Johnny for quite a while. Did this precede Pirates of the Caribbean? And you've known him for a while?
We met at the Viper Room, actually, on Sunset Boulevard 20 years ago, maybe, for the first script read through of Pirates of the Caribbean 1. None of us knew that it was going to be, you know, a success. We were doing a pirate movie, and it was Johnny and Jeffrey and all of the cast. And then around the outside, it was 9 o'clock in the morning, Matt.
At 9 a.m. at the Viper Room. It's quite a scene.
And so there was Jerry Bruckheimer and the people from Bruckheimer Films and the Disney execs who were kind of sitting around the edges. We were sitting in the middle, and you know, actors were smoking, and you could hear these coughs from these, you know, executives who weren't best pleased. And that was when we met. And we did the first movie together, and coincidentally our kids went to the same school. They weren't in the same year at school, and so, you know, my relationship grew from the movie and from there, and then doing the another few movies over time. But knowing his team and knowing the measure of who he was and how he treated people, and because that's ultimately, isn't it, regardless of whether we, going back to what we're talking about, civil discourse and cancel culture, it doesn't, all of the immutable characteristics, they don't really matter at the end of the day. They're all important, but none of it matters. It's how we treat each other. And he treated all of his employees and team and assistants and publicists and fellow castmates just so beautifully and with such generosity that I do think this is why I think this is a really, it has the potential to be a precedent setter, because he doesn't have any history of domestic violence. There is no history of a criminal record, and usually what happens in family law is judges don't take that into account when they should. Having spoken to sitting judges in family law, they agree. They're like, we should be more diligent and look at a criminal record, because it may not, just because you haven't had a history of domestic violence or a criminal record doesn't necessarily mean that you're not, you don't have the ability to do that.
Sure.
But it's a strong indicator, right? That if you're, you know, 45 years of age with a clean bill of health and
this is an odd habit to pop up in your mid 50s.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Some people comment on this, that during the course of their relationship, that was there anything that tipped you off during the course of their relationship in terms of either this relationship not being a loving one? A lot of people kind of reference kind of her cold and condescending attitude, or the remnants of physical violence. People, we've at this point seen enough videos and photos of fresh bruises, the injury to his hand. Were these things that you were cognizant of, you know, before the situation came to a head?
Well, the conversation, when you've made a few movies together within a franchise, you know, there's always a conversation on set and offset and around, in and around that. And I think it was, you know, I had Kevin McNally, who plays Joshua Gibbs in the Pirates movies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he talked about, he came on my show and talked about how the general perception was not particularly good. And, you know, I say it sounds a bit salacious to say the word in Hollywood, because, you know, actors are, we can be a prickly lot, you know, we're artists, sure. So nobody's perfect, you know. Mm-hmm. But the general consensus of everyone, not nearly everyone, everyone I've spoken to, from producers to directors to studio executives to actors, is that she's not a nice person.
Yeah.
And it's not a crime to not be a nice person. But I think what happened is the two of them, you know, they probably rushed into this relationship. Who am I to judge? I'm not judging that.
Sure.
And there were troubles and issues. And you put on top of that the pressure of celebrity and all that that brings, because they're still human beings at the end of the day, that if she hadn't fired that silver bullet, whether she chose to, you know, fire it herself, or she was kind of nudged into it, she still signed that piece of paper, that declaration, and went after that TRO. If she hadn't done that, we wouldn't be here today. But that was the moment that when she signed that piece of paper for the TRO, all bets are off and it won't end here. This is going to go on for years.
What was interesting to me, and you can hear this on some of the recordings, is that he's giving her an out, saying, can we just, let's just separate, let's just remove ourselves from each other's worlds, and I move on, you move on. But, and he's essentially tipping her off and warning her that if you keep pushing this, you know what you've done. You know what we have evidence of. I'm not going to put that on. I'm going to expose you. So if you keep on, if you want to continue with hostilities, all these things that you know you've done, I know you've done, that there's evidence of, this is going to be a conversation. And for some reason, and maybe it's because of the current milieu around Believe All Women, about public hysteria, about her beliefs that no one, her insinuations that no one will believe him, that she doesn't seem scared of that. She's almost like these criminals running around, not scared of being arrested, in that she had no fear. It would be quite the personality disorder for her to simply have removed from her memory all the things that she did that have been exposed to trial. But she was confident enough that nobody would believe him, that she felt comfortable pushing the envelope and publishing this and presenting herself as the damsel in distress, seemingly one-way victim of domestic abuse, without saying, you know something? Hey, maybe there's some marks on my record. Maybe there's some marks on his, but I've got a lot of exposure here. It's probably best for me not to try to champion myself as the you know, Wonder Woman of domestic abuse. It was just so strange.
Well, I think we have to be mindful as well of context and time. It was 2016. So, you know, the Me Too movement was, you know, in its height. And, you know, once you open the Pandora's box, you know, you can't put it back in. So, and this is why I say domestic violence has to be tried in criminal court. Violence is violence. Physical violence should be tried in criminal court. Mm-hmm. And, you know, going back to the burden of proof being on the accuser, not the accused, that's why we have that. You get your day in court. You get your Miranda rights read. You have the opportunity to be represented and speak to an attorney. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're found guilty, then you pay a price to society for that. And if you perjure yourself on the other side, or you're in contempt, you're held accountable for that. But that's not the case in the quasi-kangaroo courts, family law, and it should be.
And seemingly the only way to get recourse is to pursue a very difficult, as you said, very high threshold defamation case, which is in many cases only available to celebrities, because they're usually the ones where these allegations are made publicly and published widely. If this is something that's more of a private matter, you don't have that recourse. In one of your messages, one of your tweets about the situation and, you know, your relationship and kind of supporting Johnny through this entire scenario, you mentioned that integrity is earned in turmoil, not merely asserted in comfort. You know, I'm sure there are parallels between your own situation and Johnny's, but the character lessons and the values that someone needs to rely on and turn to in order to weather the storm of having their life turned upside down, and particularly false allegations, which must create an emotional reaction where you want to lash out. I mean, how do you grasp that? How do you stay grounded in those principles, both yourself and in guiding a compatriot in it?
Ooh, that's a good question. It's a hard one to answer with a short answer. I'm reminded of Professor Brett Weinstein, who went through a horrific situation at Evergreen College that was canceled. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was called racist time and time again by the entire group of,
he was called racist for opposing a whites don't show up at campus day. Yeah. That was apparently his crime.
Yeah. And I asked him, you know, how did you cope? And he said, well, I know I'm not. And I wasn't. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's that simple for him, you know. Answering how I was able to endure the life shattering events and sudden on March 5th, 2015, of suddenly becoming homeless and destitute. And I mean, it sounds like a Hollywood movie when I say it. You know, they stole my freedom. They kidnapped my children. They murdered my family. You know, my family doesn't exist anymore. My ability to be a father, my sons were robbed of their father 7 years ago. that will change them and has changed them forever. Mm-hmm. Every child needs their father, particularly how close and how tight my sons were. And at such an age, 8 and 10, how do they comprehend that psychological, the split psyche, if you will, between mom and dad? When adults behave badly. So how did I endure it? Well, how did I overcome it? I had a couple of really strong, loyal people in my life. I would call them my team, who were unwavering. And, you know, frankly, I was surprised at the people who turned their backs, and also surprised at the people who stood tall beside me. And, you know, that's part of why I said 6 years ago when this happened with Johnny, I stand beside, not behind and in front of or in the wings with Johnny Depp. And he is the respondent. And in a way, he's fighting for everyone who's suffered the vicissitudes of this corrupt, because I call it corrupt because it is, legal system that is run by the cartel who, you know, I mean, I keep going back to it, but it's like a 70 plus billion dollar a year industry. I call it the American divorce machine. You know, why is America the world leader in children growing up in single parent households? America, yeah. All countries, yeah. 4,000 children lose a parent in family law courts every day. That's 4,000 children a day.
That's crazy.
And of course, some of that, you know, is understandably children, you know, in vulnerable positions and need to be protected and need to be taken from those situations. But there is a large amount of them that are removed because of incentives. And some of those incentives were brought in by President Biden when he was not president in 1974, like the VAWA Act and, you know, incentivizing our states to reimburse people. The states get reimbursed $6,000 for every child placed into foster care, and there are bonuses, you know, stop grants and such to keeping those children longer. So, of course, who's going to suffer the most? The CPS and the DCFS, they have to find their, it's like parking enforcement with tickets. They have to get their quota. And the people who suffer the most are people from poor families and those who don't have the financial resources to make, you know, to find an attorney.
Would you say, and, you know, this is something I was theorizing on, and it's another point that you make quite often that I think a lot of people or an aspect of the family law regime that I think a lot of people are unaware of, is the no baseline presumption of 50-50 custody. So nobody the system does not start off anticipating equal custody amongst the parents. It's always slanted in favor of the mother, and the father then has to prove that he's either worthy of equal or, you know, or an advantage in the custody battle. And it seems like that particular aspect of the system in all of these are remnants of an outdated era where there was just one breadwinner in the family. There was only one member of the family had financial resources. Thus, the system had to make some presumptive concessions to the other member. And in an era of two breadwinner families where everybody, for the most part, is working and certainly everybody has the opportunity to work, this system is a remnant of the mid-20th century. This is not a 21st century system.
And that's really cuts right to the quick of it, Matt. You just hit the nail on the head. We, outside the courts, we have, you know, rightfully so, we've moved towards more equality. Yet inside the courts, there's still this presumption that we are, you know, father is the breadwinner and mother is the homemaker. And that's not the case. We can't have it both ways. In terms of what you said about 50-50 equal share parenting, there's really four or five main areas that I'm looking to improve in family law reform, if you will. One is obviously child support, or as I call it, the child support hustle. I've written a couple of articles about dead broke dads and black child support, because it's black men who suffer the most, particularly in places like South Carolina, you know, where it's a horrific cycle of rinse repeat, you know, that's all about the money and the welfare system. But the four other areas are, you know, the presumption of innocence that we've talked about, jurisprudence, the burden of proof must be on the accuser, not the accused. False allegations of domestic violence, there must be accountability and punishment for those parents and partners who make them and people who make them. Parental alienation is a hugely misunderstood, counterintuitive area. we need to educate the experts and parents and judges and attorneys on how to better notice the signs of parental alienation and hold those alienating parents accountable, because it's devastating. Parental alienation is child abuse. And the lastly is 50-50 shared parenting. A divorce must start with the default presumption that what is in the best interest of the children is for both parents to equally share in the parenting, notwithstanding any extreme or worrying issues. Mm-hmm. And even if there are, then after the 50-50 baseline presumption of equal or rebuttable presumption of shared parenting, they can be challenged and should be challenged. And research has shown that a rebuttable presumption of 50-50 equal shared parenting to be the single best outcome for the parents and the children post-divorce. And there's only two states right now have it. We're about to get it passed in Ohio. Well done, Ohio. Shout out to Rodney Creech, who's representative there, who has tabled this bill, and it's bipartisan. Then we move to Oklahoma, I think, Missouri, and eventually, hopefully, all the states will have this. It makes no sense to not have the starting baseline to be 50-50. That's saying that a child needs mothering and fathering, and that's equality.
Yeah. Truly, and an equilibrium amongst the sexes and a balance in the polarity that seems to be off now from a cultural perspective is off now within the media, and is certainly off, as you have explained in, you know, in excruciating detail in the court system. And hopefully, you know, through some of the taming down of the hysteria of recent eras, we can kind of start aiming towards a better balancing and equilibrium there. And we'll see the role that the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial does or does not play in that. Greg Ellis, thank you so much for being with us today. Please tell everyone where they can find you and your work.
Thanks, Matt. It's been a real pleasure. Therespondent.com, The Respondent on YouTube, Ellis Greg on Twitter, Real Greg Ellis on Instagram. And I've just recently started a community, the Respondent community. You can find the link to that. The Respondent community, you can find that on my website, therespondent.com. And that's for people who've had to endure or are suffering through, individuals and families and extended families, the vicissitudes of family law and the injustices there. And, you know, there's many people within that community. It's a safe space, as people like to say these days. And yeah, that's my book, The Respondent, which is available in the audiobook as well. If someone's got 8.5 hours to sit down and listen to an interesting story, I think it's an interesting story, and there's music and sound effects, and we're developing movie and the documentary. So this is a
fantastic.
This is a lifelong mission for me.
Very well. Best of luck to you in that mission. Thank you so much once again, Greg Ellis, The Respondent, and this was The Prevailing Narrative.
I am Matt Belinsky. Once again, you can listen and subscribe to The Prevailing Narrative on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening right now. Make sure to follow me on my socials at Matt Belinsky, MattBilinsky. The Prevailing Narrative is a Cavalry Audio production in association with iHeartRadio. Produced by Brandon Morgan, executive produced by Dana Brunetti and Keegan Rosenberger. For Cavalry Audio, I'm Matt Belinsky.